Welcome everyone for the discussion, and before going to our appointed topic or the traditional theme, I would like to ask if anyone is having any question or interview reports or any suggestion. There are no, we can go to the topic.
Sarai Bante,
yes.
We have not received any reports from this end, Bante.
Good. Then we are open to start with the Sutta Nipata. We have finished Kalaha Vivada Sutta, and we are now on Chula Vyuha Sutta. So I would like to invite Venerable Buddharakkhita to start the point where we stopped last time. Is a present day, it's a lightning conductor. Present day, it's a spikes, and earlier it was made out of brass, and keeping up of the chaitya or up of the vihara, and we call kota. Kota means the peak, the pinnacle. And later we develop into the lightning conductor. So it's diluting the static energy, because it is making a surge all the time. So there is no lightning attraction, because it is always diluting the electric, this thing. But later it changes into clay. Clay won't do it. But the thing is, before the rain, it gets wet. It is having moss. And then it's having a kind of a weak conductor to the earthening. So it is like a earth wire in the three core light system. So likewise, it's working as a, scientifically speaking, working as a lightning conductor. But it appears like a peak, the pinnacle. And the Buddha says, more you go away from the Himalaya, the Nepal, you have the highest peak of snow. Further you go there, you can see the peak far away. Dure tansi pakasenti himavanto. So likewise, it's eye catching, the pinnacle. But it has a scientific distinct also. So recently they found, the older the lightning conductor, more the amount of platinum. So there was a deep state. This thing, everyone, with the sponsorship of the government, they changed this thing, telling renovation. In the old places, everyone renovated, because they knew the lightning conductor is with ages, with each and every lightning absorbed, there is a kind of a electric electrolysis. Happening, and very rare the heavy metals are happening. So now only people comes to know, this is not to sponsor the place, but they are removing it and try to extract all the good things in the pinnacle. But that is physical. But the pinnacle means the higher spirit. And it is more go up, become less and less, ultimately ending up with the nothingness. So that is why I prepared a bed spring. A photo of a bed spring I displayed, because the bed spring is flat on the ground and slowly, slowly turning up and up and up and end up with the tip. And the more you go up there, anyone, you become a reverent and renovated, venerated, and you are about to dissolve into the nothingness. The dissolving into nothingness is the called lightning conductor. That it's electron-wise changes happening all the time. But you can't see. But when the lightning happens, not the spark happens. Then it's very dangerous. But the pinnacle never allow that kind of a big spark to happen. It's always conducting, the radiating the earth, the surge, the negative force. The cloud means the positive force. And they are also talking all the time. Lightning is always attracted to the pinnacle. But it becomes earth. It becomes the surging point. So whenever your mind becomes, whenever you go to the fourth jhana, your breath become invisible. The material part is gone. But still you feel you are not dead. There is a force. Not with the gross breath, not with the medium type breath, but it's a very subtle breath. But it not belongs to you. It's a natural phenomena. It's a lightening process. It's a lightening conductor working. So therefore there won't be any tension. There won't be any frustration because it's always compromising. That you can't see. So I went to Canada and they are preparing a special aerodynamics. They are preparing especially for the spacecraft and kind of thing. Even a light, small emission of the electrons, they can see it. They are preparing with the dynamo, very little light, very little this thing, and at the end of the electrodes, they can see the light. And how it is increasing and become visible, they know the lightning can happen. So that is very important for them to, when the something is crossing the air in a vast speed, how the accumulation of energy and lightning, how it is working with the lightning and how it is working with the clouds and the air. So they are working and they are the people making the most sophisticated tools for the NASA. Spacecrafts, how the different electrons and the protons working in the space and the air and the in the sea and the earth and the kind of thing. So it's a very area we can't see, but we are fairly now with the knowledge, scientific knowledge, but whenever it comes to the visible level, that's a different world. That's very gross. But before coming into that, just like a microscope, they are developing. So each and every vihara, and many people place gold, jewels and relics on the pinnacle. So all the looters came and destroyed all the pinnacles. And whenever earthquake happened, that will topple. And we go to Burma, you can see some vihara, they have a little conical shape, and the top is broken down. That means that place is not good for a chaitya or vihara. So they have to find a proper place with less amount of earthquakes. If there are earthquakes, this is the part they shake it and topple down. So Pegu, the early kingdom, there are a lot of places, huge chaitya broken with a lot of earthquakes. So that means they are not good. So the Pisa, for pyramids, three pyramids, and Anuradhapura, Bhruvananallisaya, Abhayagiriya, they are all exactly placed in the same angle. And these are the places the earth can hold the big objects. And that is also crowned with pinnacle. So a lot of stories, a lot of fabrications. I don't know which one to believe.
More about the significance of a rooster to Buddhism. Is there some relationship?
They are pertaining to building construction. They are architectural.
It's a sort of an architectural.
The big building and the big dagaba. When they are appearing, they are searching the place. In Burma, in China, they take the dragon line. In Sri Lanka, we take the snake lines. They know the snake lines where it is happening, like meridians. And they are the proper places for the good buildings and the good religious places. And they are in a 1 to 1.68 proportion. That is in the Greek as well as in Sri Lanka, as well as in Buddhist worlds. There are special kind of special unit. Now they are again, there is a Sri Lankan architect, Baba. He knows this. He is a Muslim, he is a Catholic or something. He is a world renowned. He speaks. He speaks how these things are working. No mystics. Measurable. One thing is lightning, other thing earthquakes. There are some lines. They know it. So therefore, before preparing a building or site, people go to an archaeologist, architect, and sometimes mystic people and ask, is this place is good? There are physical tests as well as there are magical places also. Now India developed kind of a few gadgets whereby you can see your sleep in this place is good for you. Your posture is good for you. How is the relationship with the building and you? And what are the most least place frictional or less gravitational places? They are the best for the spiritual and other places. And NASA shows the picture of the Earth without water. It's like a shrunken orange, very odd in shape. And they found two places, least amount of gravity, Bermuda Triangle and somewhere close to Sri Lanka. These places are they call stargates. The aliens can come and land. And the best places, least amount of raga, this is the gravity attraction. But it is not true because Sri Lanka is nothing when compared to least amount of friction is there, least amount of raga is there, still the same. So, but the science is leading to that kind of a mystical area because now they become little by little apparent, it might become visible to their sophisticated gadgets. So that's why you have to sit in like a pyramid, triangular in a shape, and keep yourself up. And one third is the king's seat. So heart is come to the king's seat. And all the meridians are working. So you are connected to the earth, Mother Earth. Okay.
Okay, so we'll continue with this sutta. So just to remind people again, this is a dialogue happening between the Buddha and a psychic form of the Buddha. The Buddha makes a copy of himself. And so the copy is asking the Buddha questions. And the purpose of this is so that the devas, who are the audience, can listen in. And the Buddha has the opportunity to kind of answer some very deep questions as a result of this dialogue. In this sutta, the Buddha is looking at arguments, the different kind of arguments that teachers and wise people and clever people put forward, and he calls this the deployments, like how people deploy their arguments. So it's like from the general's perspective, how people organize their arguments. So the psychic Buddha begins by asking questions, and then the Buddha answers these questions. So we had begun with the first question from the psychic Buddha, where he's asking how come when people are settled in their views that they can have very skillful arguments, and how can we know the truth? Because these people are very convincing, and how can we know the truth? Because they will just object to anybody else saying that you're a fool and you're unskillful. So the Buddha answers, if one who does not affirm the opponent's doctrine is thereby a fool, a brute, deficient in wisdom, all indeed are fools, utterly deficient in wisdom, for all these are settled in their views. But if by their own view they are cleansed, pure in wisdom, skilled, intelligent, there is none among them deficient in wisdom, for their views are similarly taken up. I do not say this is correct, as the fools in pairs say to one another. They all take their own view to be true, therefore they consider the opponent a fool. So here this is a very interesting, he takes three stanzas to answer the first question, which is why I've had to take it in a block. And what's very interesting here is how universal the Buddha is in his perspective. So he doesn't say that you're a Buddhist, or he doesn't say that you're a Christian or a Muslim, and if you're automatically in one camp or another camp, because if you have this particular kind of view that is self-cleansing, that it purifies your mind by wisdom, and it brings you to skillful, intelligent states of mind, and that as a result of this, you don't have any defect due to this purification by wisdom, then you come to the same truth. So just by joining the club, it doesn't make you a person who is in the right club or has the right view or has the right truth. It's only when the truth itself becomes purifying to the mind and purification by wisdom. So, it's because later on we're going to get into more discussion about how can we know truth, how can we differentiate, how can we know anything. So this is really a deep discussion on how we can know anything, how we can learn anything. And as I said, the Buddha here is very nonpartisan. He points the way is by wisdom. And ultimately, anybody who has these kind of views, if by their own views they are cleansed, pure in wisdom, skilled and intelligent, there is none amongst them defective in wisdom, for their views are similarly taken up. So it's a very interesting statement. So then the Buddha says, I do not say this is correct, as the pairs and fools say to one another. So in arguments, people will always try to say, I'm right and you're wrong. So this is the pair that he calls foolish. He says you're foolish to assert that you're correct, and you're foolish to assert that that the other person is false. So, this is almost the hallmark of a foolish argument, is one side is saying I'm right and accusing the other of being wrong. Whereas, as we go through the rest of the sutta, you'll see where he says there is only one truth. So when somebody asserts that something is true, and if they genuinely know it's true, they're not going to argue about it. They understand that the other person doesn't know this truth, and they understand that there's no point in arguing about the case. And they understand that the only way that you can know for yourself is that you must know for yourself, and if you have this right view and if you cultivate wisdom, it is self-purifying and you come to your own insight and understanding of it. And it doesn't matter what label you are, if you're a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim or something like that, as long as you're practicing the right way, you are going to come to your own self. You will come to truth. So the rest of the sutta is going to go through different sort of aspects of how he repeats this point consistently, but he gives it here in this in his first answer straight away. Maybe you'd like to answer.
I have not much to add, but as far as you are with this kind of argument, there cannot be any sectarianism, because you are always ready to accept the other party. Yeah. And sectarianism is, this is the truth. And start like in India, there's a lot of gods. And they found one god is better than a lot of gods. Same thing happened in Greece. There's a lot of gods. And ultimately, God idea is to have a single god. And the single god is the Christian god, Jewish god, and the Muslim gods. And then now, they are fighting each other. Now, they are fighting the many gods. How do you call pantheon of the god? Pantheon? Pantheon of the gods? That the range. So the Buddha is not telling the range or single. He says all these things are defensive. You are going to defend something. So therefore anyone says two gods fighting with. But India you go, their father is Hindu. Father is the Ganesh. Mother is Sai Baba. And the son is Rama, Radha Rama. No problem. All the gods are there. Arena. No problem. But if you go to Muslim, Allahu Akbar. There's no other. So then fighting. And now what the Americans or something did, the Muslim also two sects, Sunni, Shia. They are fighting. Sunni, the cemetery, other people can't bury. There cannot be such a thing according to the Adhisthi, because this is the. So that is the point where science also got lost. But lucky enough, science is critical about the science itself. So therefore, science can evolve. So therefore, what do you mean by science? There is no such a thing. There is no person called scientist. Because he is disproving himself. That is why the Newtonian physics went into Einstein physics. So the solid part is dissolving, but the science is evolving. So among the Christian, Catholic kind of thing, the Catholic is more dynamic. So always changing, changing, changing. Easy to fit into Buddhism, easy to fit into science. So present day, all scientific books and everything is controlled by these bodies. They are the big scientists. So I got a huge amount of the Scientist magazine. I found a lot of interesting articles. So when a senior monk come, I told, this is the way Bhante, they are proving that there is no matter, there is a subatomic particle. Then he asked, do you know this magazine is run by a Catholic church? So they are the one teaching us. But the Buddha destroyed everything. And he says, if someone is telling this is the truth, please avoid such a fool. There is no such. They are evolving thing, dialectic, and specifically the materialism. And when it is a consolidated, the communist idea come into being. So nowadays still, the jam is the jam, salad is the salad. There's no change happen. Whatever the science came, whatever the revolutionary thing happened, our mind is always in a split. In a left brain and the right brain is happy to accept everything as a one unit. Left brain is always analytical. So we can't sleep. So that is why the Buddha says God can't understand that. Even the religious people can't understand that. That is why the imagination of another Buddha, he is asking question. So lay people commoners, they can't ask a question. Because they are always obsessed with something. So this is why we are going to expand it. So I would like to invite to go proceed. If anyone is having, please.
Excuse me, Swaminath sir. I wanted to just... what I'm getting from this is just that normally, conventionally, we stick to... We like to have an answer. We like to have something solid. And so with views, that's what happens is people are saying this is the truth. And then somebody else is going to oppose that. And then there's fighting. And the Buddha is saying that everything is changing. So there can't be any one view that's correct. And so we have to actually come to that realization that there is no fixed reality. Through meditation, we can experience things changing moment to moment, and we can see how our views even change from moment to moment based on our emotional states and how much we are wanting certain things. At around lunchtime, I'm maybe thinking about food, but you know, before I go to bed, there's the world completely changes to be some other reality. So the way I think of that right now, and about this discussion, and thank you.
So that's why I like mindfulness. Mindfulness never take a stand, choicelessly be aware. So therefore, I give a like a panacea. That it says there is no panacea for all the questions, but there is a panacea. To start with, have a mindfulness and the open-mindedness, and the mindfulness is defined as choiceless awareness. So therefore, as far as you are mindful, there cannot be any sectarianism, there cannot be any hard and fast argumenting, so we can be mindful. Yes, American.
Avasarai Swaminasa. Thank you for your wonderful comments, and thank you Bhante and Bhante for your wonderful comments as well. I would say that's my comment, I would say, is rather brief. It's just the true mark of wisdom, I would say, is when, as some people I think have mentioned already, is when you don't feel like you need to prove yourself. So if you know, excuse me, smoke in my eyes, if you know that that you're on the correct path, or you know what you're talking about, you're not going to need to go and argue with other people about that. I mean, most people, I mean, if you argue with somebody else about, you know, whatever you believe in, most people would just see it as like a personal attack, and like you're coming after them, or you're personally attacking them. And again, you know, if you start arguing with this person, as I was, I think, alluding to last week, you've kind of just constructed an identity around your beliefs and how you're just reacting off of that. However, if you are sure that you're on the right path, or you're sure about your beliefs, and you don't need to, you know, fight anyone over those beliefs or argue with anyone over those beliefs, you know, that's a true mark of wisdom right there. Is, you know, I don't need to do what everyone else in the world is doing, which is constantly bickering and debating about their viewpoints and really never getting anywhere, just kind of providing, you know, each other with more proof that the other one is supposedly a fool. You know, like people, you know, will get into debates and arguments simply to defend their own beliefs or viewpoints, and simply to prove that the other person is in fact a fool. So the true mark of wisdom is when you don't need to debate or argue other people about your beliefs. You're just sure about it, and you're comfortable in your own skin, you could say. You're comfortable about what you're doing, and you're sure of what you're doing, and you don't need anyone else to validate that, you know. So that's the comment that I have. Thank you all.
Maybe I'm not clear, but from my understanding, and maybe I can go on to the next verse, but the Buddha is not saying that there is no truth. There is an absence of truth. No, he's saying there is a truth. It's just that having a view, unless you have a right view, doesn't bring you to that truth. And whatever sectarian group you're in, it doesn't matter if your view is bringing you is purifying you by wisdom and bringing you to the truth. So maybe we can get into the next few verses, and you'll see he's not saying there's no truth. He said that there is a truth, and a wise person knows this truth. He just knows not to argue with people about that, that they can't see what the wise person sees, because they haven't purified their mind. They're not purified by wisdom itself. So it's not a Pollyanna theory that a kumbaya and all is good and everybody's all together. This kind of like a Hindu thing is that we're all part of the Hindu pantheon. And in Christianity and in Islam, we're all part of God. We're all the little souls of God. That's not what he's saying at all. He's saying that by purification, by wisdom, there is one truth, and you come to it. You know, there is an ultimate truth. But anyway, we can move on if people are happy with that. Have you anything further to comment on that, Bhante?
That's why we become Buddhist. So we have Four Noble Truths. So that everything is changing, so we can, the whole day we can talk about it's a truth or not truth. We need no any Kalaviva Sutta. We can just say on that itself. So therefore we have to evolve. There is a truth. That truth is evolution. It's a kind of a dialectic thing. Don't stand. Don't take a stand. And please carry on.
So I'll carry on then. So then the psychic Buddha again asks another question. Those who take good behavior as supreme speak of purity through self-control. Having taken up an observance, they settle on it, thinking, let's train right here then there would be purity. Claiming to be skilled, they are led back into existence. So then the Buddha replies, if he has fallen away from good behavior and observances, he trembles because he has purity in his action. He longs and yearns for purity here, like one on a journey who has lost his caravan. But having abandoned all good behavior and observances, and their deeds blameworthy and blameless, not yearning for either purity or impurity, one should live detached, not grasping peace. So here's...
Which number?
Oh, sorry. You're correct. I skipped on to the next...
stanza.
The next sutta, actually, which is again the same name.
Mahavyuha.
Sorry. No, it's number where I. Yeah, correct. Sorry, I pulled over two pages. Sorry, that which some say is true, correct, others say is hollow, false. Having contended thus, they dispute, why do ascetics speak in unison? Why don't ascetics speak in unison? Truth indeed is one. There is no second. A person who understands this would not dispute. These proclaim their own diverse truths. Therefore, ascetics do not speak in unison. So here again, he continues with this hallmark of almost of people who haven't come to an understanding. Because they take an extreme position. They'll say this is true and correct, and the other one will say this is hollow and false. And having contended their argument, then they stand their ground. So in this way, ascetics do not speak in unison. But truth indeed is one. There is no second. So there's only one truth. There is no second truth. Just one truth. So we a person who understands this would not dispute. So a person who knows the truth understands when there's a falsity being spoken about. And if they know that this person cannot be, they understand why this person doesn't know. They just don't know. But they have a view, they have an opinion and an argument, and they're going to argue about it. And you can tell them, well, you know, I know this because I've seen this directly myself. And the other person, well, that's just your opinion. And in the modern times, it's called having alternative facts. It was a very interesting expression by one political advisor to Trump that, they would say that Trump had alternative facts. So if you asked him why was he lying, he wasn't lying. He just had alternative facts. Like, I'm not trying to make political points around Trump. In fact, he's fascinating and a lot to be learned from.
That is a psychopath. You are a friend.
You know,
only a psychopath.
So, but we can learn from it. It's very amusing. It's amusing, that such argumenters will try to destroy your sense of reality. And when we practice mindfulness, what mindfulness is cultivating and developing is an intimate sense of reality. I intimately know that things are impermanent. How do you know? Because everything is impermanent. I'm not sure that everything is impermanent. My reality is that it's my point of view is that everything is permanent. You know, so it's like, okay, your point of view is everything is permanent is coming from that you don't see the change. So how can I help you to see that everything is impermanent and see the change? That doesn't fit into my worldview. Well, then I can't help you. Do you understand? So it's this aspect of the Dhamma that it leads you itself to truth. And once you know that truth, you can never see it otherwise. You know, it's like a perception, you know, like it's like one of, like Venerable Dhammajiva likes these images, and you look at them and one way it's an old lady and another way it's a young lady, or one way it's a dolphin or something else, you know. And once you see it, you have to work very hard to see it differently. You know, it's just how the mind is. And, you know, but when you see truth...
That was the Gestalt concept.
Yeah.
That is the very late I understand what is the meaning of Gestalt theory. Sometimes you have a patterns and you can look it from this way, so they are definitely you can't see the other way. If you, someone is looking from the other way, he can't see the original way. So I collected all the Gestalts and published to say once you attracted to that, you never see the other. So likewise, the Gestalt theory is a kind of a theory for psychopaths and the psychiatrically imbalanced people. But he can see other alternatives. But Buddha says, Athiva nacha balanam. Don't go with these fools. They are never leading to the truth. They are going to mislead you. They are going to desperate you and desiccate you. And therefore, leave it aside. Because earlier I read all the books. And I found whether the particular author has seen the Buddha, heard the Buddha, practiced the Buddha. Never. They are utter fools. They are telling the truth, telling the false in long, long terms. Very long, the same half-truth. In the way, so they get the Nobel Prizes. All the Nobel laureates, utter mad. Utter mad. They never think about the teaching of the Buddha, reality. Who am I? So no way is not only developing dynamite, they are making Nobel Prizes. It's also another dynamite. The same person, Nobel, did the mercenary thing. First created the dynamite, then created the Nobel Prize. Everyone misled. So my books, we have enough books I have read. Now before taking, I just see, Namo Buddhaya, if he's starting with the respecting the Buddha, something worth reading. Otherwise, these fools are misleading. Utter misleading. But
Are you just being partisan? Unless it says Namo Tassa at the start, I can't read anything.
Everything.
There's no truth in anything else.
No. Yeah, that is I believe. That's why I became a monk. And that's why I became a Theravada. That I have no Namo Tassa. That's also I am fairly a master. I know Tripitaka fairly. I'm not the fully master. But I check with the other person is just believing Anicchang. No. Then why should I waste my time? Anicchang Asevanacha Balanam Panditanacha Sevana. Don't have a friendship with such a guy. Because as you mentioned, if he's not ready to understand their mistakes, why waste our time? Are we responsible to correct others? Never. No. We are having some kind of innocence. We are ready to accept others' ideas and argument, so we can have a discussion. We are not going for the running for the next election campaign. We are not having any sectarianism. We can argue because we have no minuous ideas behind that. So therefore, we are genuine. But all the other guys, they have the dirty idea behind. They don't also know, but it's a kind of a malice. Kind of a malice. That Vindama Jnanananda, Dhammika helped me, I hope, to find what is his agenda. If you know the agenda, then whatever he is going to say is a camouflage, it's a show. I can get amused, but there's no truth. Because Buddha has completely recovered it. Why should we go for the second hand? Why should you go for the duplicates?
Yeah, and it comes very much into these two pits of everything is grey goo. Like we can all get together and we can all find a common ground and have a consensus. And this works for a lot of things in the world, but it doesn't work with truth. You don't arrive to truth through consensus. And you don't arrive to truth with like some extreme view. You arrive with truth only through the self-purification process by wisdom itself and by directly seeing for yourself and by direct intimate observation with Yatha Bhuta Dasana, with things as they really are and tracing things back to the cause and seeing the causal relationships going on, seeing this dependent origination, seeing the eightfold path, seeing the Four Noble Truths. And these are universal things. You can see them for yourself immediately here and now. And it's not a belief. It's a very clear description of the world the way it really is, and you either see it or you don't, and it isn't a persuadable point. And that's why it is a method in in the Buddhist path. It's not ultimately, there's a doctrine, but the doctrine is a method to practice. And if you practice, you see it for yourself. And if you don't, you will never see it. And you can't persuade other people. And so, you know, if you've ever, I've been invited to these interfaiths and other groups. And it's just like, oh, we're all brothers. And you're like, in what? You know, we don't have any of the same common practices. We're not, you know, so we can't come to the same point. You know, we can agree to disagree. We can agree to not fight with each other. We can agree to not argue with each other. But we can't agree on the same truth, because there just isn't the causes and conditions for them to actually see the truth. So our job is to just put in the causes and conditions, and the truth reveals itself.
So interview is good for time wasting. Interfaith discussions is very good for time wasting. Time was no time wasting.
Well, maybe not.
Excuse me, Swaminatha Bhante. So then, what I get from this is something I've picked up, I've thought of. I think it seems to be an essence of Buddhism, is that we don't rely on anything. So this would be, you know, not relying on any, you know, things of the world to persuade us or to attract us. The Buddha's wisdom is based on, it doesn't rely on anything that we can put our, you know, that we can,
Any dogma.
Okay, yes. So, thank you, Swaminatha. Dogma or any views. So he's guiding us to try to find the way without relying on anything. And except for his guidance of how to do that. Maybe like the Eightfold Noble Path can help us, and the Four Noble Truths makes us go in the right direction towards that, and then we have to realize it directly through, I guess, primarily meditation, mindfulness, seeing things.
Be here and now.
Yes, Swami. Thank you, Swami. And then as far as interfaith groups, I've been involved with interfaith groups before, that, and there is one thing that all faiths, I think, agree on, or that, like, the first five precepts of that we follow in Buddhism, and so that's one thing we can agree on as far as interfaith, to abide by those precepts.
Smoking, because to make purified or quarantine. Quarantine.
Avasarai Swaminatha. Thank you to all of you for the wonderful comments again. Interestingly enough, Bhante, you were talking about interfaith groups and, sort of the way a lot of countries and societies are nowadays, where there will be like a majority of the people and they will have a belief, or there will be different groups of people and they will try to find ways to make everyone be somehow telling the truth, you know, and they will try to involve, you know, everyone in the discussions, and, you know, everybody's correct, everybody's telling the truth in some way, shape, or form. But yeah, you know, that's not entirely true, you know. A lot of people, like, nowadays, they'll see, like, if, like, the majority of a society has a belief of some kind, and, you know, everyone hops on that belief, oh, okay, this must be the truth, you know, somehow this is the truth, because everybody in society, or a lot of people in society, are saying this. But that's not necessarily true, you know, and that's totally not true, per se. And this is the wonderful thing about the Dhamma, is that the Dhamma is to be practiced, as I think you were mentioning, Bhante, a second ago. The Dhamma is to be practiced, and you're supposed to experience it for yourself. So you know, you understand the way of the Dhamma is that you're understanding the truth through your own personal experience. It's not a thing of like, oh, you know, everybody is just saying this, so it must be true, you know, because everyone else is saying it. It's a thing of, well, I know the truth because I've seen it for myself. I've seen it and I've experienced it for myself, and that is why I'm not going to debate you or argue with you on this, is because I know what I believe in. You know, it's that kind of surety, and so that's the wonderful thing about the Dhamma, is that it's about wisdom. It's about experiencing and understanding the truth for yourself to the point where you don't need to like debate anyone. You're that sure about the truth that it's like, I don't even need to speak to you about it. And it's like, so, yeah, that's the comment that I have.
So Dhamma is not democratic. It's a full capitalistic. If everyone is believing, it's not truth. Majority believing means not truth. That's why the Buddha says, go to the forest, sit under a tree, and it will be awesome. It is not be very familiar, it is not very popular, but maybe the truth, maybe the bitter. So therefore you must have opening personality to understand the Dhamma. Otherwise you can embrace religion. That's a multi-faith. So there, 80% of the people, I am leading the Buddhist perspective in the United Nations regarding the environment, and led by a Muslim, Liat, and I am giving the mindfulness for Earth, and UN appreciating, you people are tackling 80% of the population. But it is not for enlightenment. It is just for the nature. It is not just for the global warming and the... They say, for that, no, okay. But now the crisis, not the interfaith, not the global warming, but the Ukraine war, which is man-made. And now Taiwan and China, what the UN can do? UN prepared for another political conspiracy. So you think that UN can come and sort them out? No, they are very happy with the war. And they are very much sponsoring faith for Earth, mindfulness for Earth, prayer for Earth. So they are just the advertisements in the television. I mean, entertainments. Once in a way, you must have some kind of feel good. So therefore, you must have in your religious life, in a serious forest meditators, you must have a little bit of entertainment. And for that, interfaith, environmental, female rights, and no poison, and lack of poison, and utter ego, happy, and the green, everything natural. What nonsense. So they came during our age. Please remember, our parents were not much exposed with that. They were started the primordial, but during our time, I never thought it will come to the maturity. Now it is coming and putrefied. Everything putrefied. The war is happening. Beautiful. Beautiful. It is not ugly. It is beautiful because nothing to argue with it. But as you mentioned, you can have your own way. I would simply put, be mindful and mind your own business.
Bhante, I would really quickly like to point out too that one of the things that I found most interesting personally about the Buddhist teachings, specifically the Four Noble Truths, I think this is what captivated me and kind of caused me to become a Buddhist, is the fact that when the Buddha states the Four Noble Truths, like, you know, there is the truth of suffering and stuff, it's like, well, yeah, this is true. Like, clearly it's true. And it's funny because it is true and we can see it, but so many people, like, it's like right in front of their faces, but they don't say it. It's like if all of us are wearing orange robes and none of us says, well, hey, we're all wearing orange robes, but we're like all wearing orange robes and it's clear that we're all wearing orange robes, but no one ever says it. It's just like, we're wearing something, you know? And that's what I found interesting about the Four Noble Truths, is like, you know, the truth of suffering. Well, you know, yeah, there is. It is true that all beings are suffering, and it was like nobody is saying it though. You know, it's like it's right in front of our faces, but nobody is saying it. And that that's the thing about truth and wisdom. And that's the thing about the Dhamma is you're experiencing the truth for yourself and you see it. And, you know, a lot of these concepts are, you know, considered abstract, you know, you could say the world over, but you're experiencing the truth for yourself. And so that's what, that was very interesting for me. You know, that's what captivated me, I would say, to, and caused me to become a Buddhist is this fact that, you know, there's like, it was the Four Noble Truths. There is this truth of suffering, and obviously this is true and I can see that, but nobody is like saying that. And that was very interesting. So, you know, we're talking about that a little here, where it's the truth is to be experienced by yourself, and you have to experience it for yourself. You can't discover the truth by just listening to what everyone else in society is saying.
So. Truth is something to survive. Truth is something to suffer. That's all.
Sorry. In my own development, I remember Siado Ukundala. He was asked the question, "What is faith in Buddhism?" And his answer was, "Faith in Buddhism is just the faith you put in your meditation object." So, like, I've come to rely on my meditation object. So if you think that there's nothing reliable in the world, actually your meditation object and your meditation practice is the thing that you have to come to rely on. And it's that's going to bring you to wisdom and to enlightenment and to truth. So that's the gateway. And then you confirm your faith in your object by the self-revelation of wisdom itself. Faith leads ultimately through insight back to wisdom, and wisdom feeds back into faith and a confirmed confidence in your object. So it's not like we don't have anything. We have nothing in Buddhism. We have our object of meditation. The characteristic of that object of meditation is that it is anicca, anatta, and dukkha, those tilakana. So that's an important point as well. There is truth, and there is an object of meditation, and there is a practice, and there is a method, and there is the self cleansing of wisdom.
Vasudev, thank you, Mahasangha. Thank you, Mahathero, for the comments. Yeah, what comes to mind is one verse also from the Suttanipata, talking about how what the worldlings think is true, the noble ones know is false. And what the worldlings think is false, the noble ones know is true. And so it does seem quite clear that there isn't just one giant abstract truth that everyone can just come to agree on. And I suppose the one thing that does bind us all is just the fact that we're all going to die. And especially in today's age, that's something that I think a lot of people neglect, that truth. And religion came about to kind of answer that truth. But I do feel that the path of the Buddha taught is the only one that teaches how to directly overcome that truth, that kind of unfortunate truth. But as we were saying with the interfaith, I do think it's important to kind of keep that Buddhist identity a bit, just for the sake of at least knowing where one stands, so that not everything is just so kind of wavy. And it doesn't mean that we have to throw that view at others and kind of shove it down their throat, but to at least know for ourselves what we believe in, and at least have some idea of what path to follow down that. Because otherwise, if one just gets a little bit of everything from everywhere, then things will get very confusing. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes. I hope we can proceed.
So the next question from the Psychic Buddha is, but why do they assert diverse truths, those proponents who claim to be skilled? Are those truths actually many and diverse, or do they follow a line of reasoning? So the Buddha replies, truths surely are not many and diverse. except by mistakenly perceiving permanent things in the world. But having formulated reasoning about views, they assert the dyad true and false. So again, very pertinent to what we've already even been discussing is like, I would just relate it back to actually Vedana and Upasana. You know, once there's whatever object is arising, we immediately label it like or dislike, or neither like nor dislike. So here it's like is true, dislike is false. So it's this instantaneous process that if you become increasingly mindful of your own mind, you're aware of it. Immediately we're labeling true or false, like, dislike. So we have this diversity of truths, and just the skilled are able to, you know, they're able to say black is white and up is down. And so that just because they can do that and just because they say that doesn't mean that there is a diversity in truth, and that it's a mistaken perception of permanence in the world. So again, this comes back to this underlining that if you have your object of meditation and faith in your object of meditation, it will lead you to a repeated experience that everything is anicca, everything is anatta, everything is dukkha, everything is anicca, anatta, dukkha. And that is the characteristics. It's not that the thing is suffering, it's that the characteristic of the thing is suffering. Like, the thing could be hard, it could be soft, it could be bright, it could be dark, but it is anicca, it is anatta, it is dukkha, this characteristic, this fundamental characteristic, and that's an experience. And otherwise, we just think true or false. Well, like the light is bright or it's dark. You know, it's not true or false. It's just the way it is, and it's anicca, anatta, and dukkha. It doesn't have a value on it. It's not true or false. It's not. So it's this perception of the permanence, as he says here, that it is anatta. That is, it's atta. And that's what you see in other people, in their views. There's always a permanence. No, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. And there's that kind of insistence on the permanency, or it's not the way it is. It's a nihilism, and it's a denial of the way it is. So one is eternal, one is nihilistic. So you can see how these philosophies and views just build on that very simple thing, that they're not seeing that it is impermanent. They're not seeing that it is just arising because of process, anatta, and that that suffering is a characteristic that comes with that quality. They all come together, and it's just, it's not an opinion, it's not a view. You have to experience these things, and you have to experience it like millions and billions and billions and billions of times, and you can't persuade yourself. You can't just agree with it philosophically. You have to deeply experience it in your heart. In every moment, it's just it becomes a weight and a crushing force till it just explodes, and you that's the way it is. The yata bhuta nasana, that's the way it is. And so anyway, that's all I have to say on that little section.
Now we are about to end the discussion, but I would say, as Venerable mentioned, we have to take nimitta, we have to take object of meditation and disprove it. Yeah. Nimitta become animitta. Then you become enlightened. Without taking a nimitta, what to disprove? So therefore, you have to take negative argument and disprove it. That's called negative.
Via negative.
Not the negative. It's called the word came and disappeared, and argue. Hypothesis, that is, you take this is wrong.
Thesis and antithesis.
Thesis, and then you disprove it. That is the counter-argument. And that's a very, very good way of presenting in the reasoning in adult psychology. And therefore, you take it, yes, there is atta. There is a set, there is a breath, there is a walking. And you deep into, scrutinize into that, till that there is no atta. So you take nimitta. You meditate up to animitta, you meditate up to appanihita, meditate up to sunyata. So without taking nimitta, you can't start. So taking nimitta does not indicate you are going to prove it, you are going to disprove it.
that hypothesis, null hypothesis we call. Null, you take a null hypothesis, agree with the teacher, agree with the object, and practice to see whether your hypothesis you have taken as null hypothesis, anicca dukkha anatta, permanent, pleasurable, and atta. So you are destroying yourself. That is what you call epistemological, you are suicidal. You take in an object to disprove it. Take a nimitta, practice after the animitta. So that is only I am talking about vipassana, not in samatha. Samatha is a kind of a confirming the same object and you abiding by, you enter into just like a bunker and you take rupa jhana, arupa jhana. No harm, good, because you are not destroying others. But whenever the vipassana, that very object you have taken as nimitta, you have to see it's a false, it's a fabrication, it's a animitta. So that is called vimukti marga, that three characteristic, animitta, appanisa, sunyata. So ultimately you have facing a huge psychological barrier. Are you going to prove the object or disprove the object? Are you going to prove the null hypothesis or disprove the null hypothesis? So teacher has a very big role. The inferential knowledge is having a big role and rational knowledge is having a big role, not at the beginning. When you have enough experience, you have to put into the inferential knowledge. That is why we are having a discussion. That's why we have taken the Sutta Nipata as the topic. And it's keeping the subject open, not telling that not to take an object. Take it an object as a permanent, suffering, pleasurable, and atta. Disprove it. That is what you call taking a null hypothesis and disproving it. See, in that sense, I like science. Not to prove it is a true. To prove it is disprove. Okay, I think we have to go to Pindapaya. Thank you very much. Today's discussion is more on the view, our experience, than the book. So thanks to the Kala Vichula Viva Sutta. Thanks everyone for participating.